Hey folks, today's show is sponsored by Starry Station, the touchscreen router that gives you blazing fast Wi-Fi. If you've ever been watching a show online and it starts to buffer, the worst thing are those blinking lights on your router that tell you nothing. Starry Station changes all that by showing you your entire network on one screen. It tells you when there's an issue and suggests ways to fix it. It also tells you your speed so you'll know if you're getting the speed you pay for, finally. It's also got parental controls, and if you ever need help, you can request a support call from the touchscreen. Learn more about Starry Station at starry.com/Marin. We're also sponsored by MeUndies. Nothing can describe the fit and feel of MeUndies, but once you try them on, you'll understand why they're called the world's most comfortable underwear. And if you don't love your first pair of MeUndies, they're free. No questions asked. Shipping is free in the U.S. and Canada, and you can save up to $8 a pair with the MeUndies subscription plan. Get the subscription or a single pair and take 20% off your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/WTF. That's MeUndies.com/WTF for 20% off your first order. Yeah. MeUndies. Let's do the show.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? I'm Mark Maron. This is my show, WTF. Thank you for joining me. I don't know when I've gotten so professional about that, the sort of intro. Nice to have you. Welcome. Welcome aboard the vessel. Just got back from Conan and went well. It was nice to see everybody. I like hanging out. I took my niece, Matana, over there. She's in town. Showed her the studio. Uncle Mark showing around show business out there on the Warner lot, telling her about the old days when they shot everything, all the movies there. They still shoot everything there. I love going on a studio lot. It's sort of interesting to acknowledge and realize that you're in fucking show business when you're in show business, and nothing really hammers at home like driving onto a studio lot. And there's only a few, but Warner Brothers is like one of the big ones, just sound stages upon sound stages as far as the eye can see. Well, that's an exaggeration. There's a lot of sound stages, but there's something about realizing like this is a business. This is where they make the product in these places. And Conan's got a pretty permanent situation over there on one of the big sound stages on the Warner lot. And it's always exciting to go over there. And I'm glad I was funny. So my little niece didn't have to go like, yeah, that's my uncle. You don't have to watch it, though. That was fun. So you can go watch that at teamcoco.com or whatever the hell it is. Find it. Hope you're watching my TV show. That was on last night. A funny episode with Joey Diaz. Next week is great, too. It only gets, wow, I guess I'm really into my own TV show. It only gets more fun. Today on the show, what do we got? Daniel Clowes, the amazing Daniel Clowes is here, graphic novelist, comic artist, creator of many powerful, impactful things in my life. The 8-Ball comics, Lloyd Llewellyn, Like a Velvet Glove, Cast Iron. There's so many. Ghost World. His new book is pretty fucking amazing. Patience. I love talking to these guys. I've talked to a few of the graphic novelist, comic artist guys, and it's always interesting to me because I was never a Marvel Universe person or a real sort of hardcore comic person, but I guess what they would call underground comics were always very important to me, and he's one of the big dudes. I was thrilled to talk to him. Also, I'm going to be talking to Ezra Edelman, whose amazing OJ documentary, OJ Made in America, premieres this Saturday, June 11th on ABC. And that's just part one. Then parts 2 through 5 will air the following Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday on ESPN. I watched all this stuff, like binged it completely when I got the screeners. It's one of the most profound and beautifully layered documentaries I've ever seen in my life. And you cannot stop watching it. And it's about so much more than you could even anticipate. So Clowes and Edelman today, and we'll get to that in a second. On the AT&T front, they've sent some people. Some technicians came over. They did the readings. They brought the meter. There's not a lot of dangerous rays coming into the office, apparently. I'll trust these guys. They're subcontractors. They have nothing invested in lying to me. But they did offer me some hope on the mundane and ridiculous luxury problem of my stereo issue. They're going, apparently it's the Heritage Box. That means anything to you? You know a lot more about cell towers than I do. The Heritage Box is what the stereo's picking up, and that's the oldest box up there to, I guess, service some flip phones and some other things. And there's a frequency it emits that my old stereo, which is a Heritage stereo, just by coincidence, is picking it up. So they had some big ideas about a blanket or some shield. They were talking shields. They were talking RF shield blankets. All sounded good. They were decent guys dealing with a neurotically obsessed idiot myself who just wants to be comfortable and listen to records in his office when he wants to, and also doesn't want to be irradiated to the point of insanity. So that's what's going on that front. They're on it. We'll see if they let these subcontractors do it. All right? Okay. We're sponsored today by Audible.com. That is the home of more than 180,000 audio programs. That's a lot of stuff to listen to, people. Books, magazines, radio, podcasts. You have so many possibilities. Let me help you out here and narrow it down. Let's get some suggestions. Let's just go over here to Audible, search. How about OJ? OJ Simpson. Oh, geez. A lot of stuff. Raging Heart, the tragic marriage of O.J. Simpson and Nicole Brown Simpson. That's an understatement, but that's available. What do we got? O.J. Simpson, the real story. All right. Police test knife reportedly found on property once owned by O.J. Simpson. Seems to be a radio show. Ooh, Can't Forgive, My 20-Year Battle with O.J. Simpson by Kim Goldman, who's Goldman's sister. Yeah, sad. It's also narrated by her. But you get the point. All right. The point is there's so much to listen to at audible.com, and you can listen wherever you want, at the gym, during your commute, in the shower, anywhere, anytime. Their free app works on just about every device, and they also have the great listen guarantee. If you decide you don't like the book you chose, no worries. You can exchange any book you aren't happy with for another title anytime, no questions asked. And for WTF listeners, audible.com is offering a free 30-day trial membership. Go to audible.com/WTF to start your free trial today. Show your support for WTF and get a free 30-day trial at audible.com/WTF. Okay? All right, we got a full show here, so let's get to it. As I said before, Ezra Edelman is the director of OJ Made in America, which premieres this Saturday, June 11th on ABC. That's just part one. Then parts 2 through 5 will air the following Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday on ESPN. Oh, and speaking of docs, how many of you guys saw that doc? Well, I guess it's on the festival circuit. I don't know if you would. The one I narrated called Sidemen, Long Road to Glory. It's screening this Saturday at Bonnaroo. And then in the UK on June 22nd, go to SidemenFilm.com for screening information. Docs everywhere. I just watched a screener of the JT Leroy doc. That was something. Yeah, plenty of docs. No shortage of docs in the world. But this OJ doc is insane, and it's genius. And I'm going to talk to the man that was at the helm of it, Mr. Ezra Edelman, right now. All right, so here's my experience with the documentary. OJ Made in America. So I get this link, and as we were talking about before, Neil Brennan, who we both know, came up to me at the Comedy Store, like, you know, starry-eyed, like, dude, you gotta watch this. You gotta watch this OJ Made in America. I'm like, is it on? He's like, no, it's not on yet. I think he watched it maybe twice. He's like, I watched it twice. I'm like, all right, dude. He's like, seriously. And I'm like, I get it. I'm gonna watch it. Because I knew I was gonna talk to you. So I get the thing, and sure enough, you know, you enter this world with this movie that's on, or the miniseries, or whatever the fuck it is. Like, I
docu-series.
Yeah, I have no interest in it. Like, I don't care. And then, like, I get the links to your thing, and I'm like, all right, well, I said to my producer, I'm like, wait, is there a question about whether he did it or not? And Brendan's like, no, it's not about that. And I'm like, well, okay. Like, I didn't know what it was going to be about. And then, you know, you watch it, and, you know, where you start, you know, at, you know, in Potrero Hill, San Francisco, the neighborhood OJ came from. And then you're sort of like, when I tell people about it, you're really tracking. It's a documentary about race, about the relationship of the black community with the LAPD, about civil rights to a degree. Like, you know, for the first 3 hours.
You're like, where's the murder?
Right. Well, kind of. But I mean, I didn't think it would necessarily be about that. But what does it take when you, what was, because it really is about, it's about celebrity culture. It's about race. It's about Los Angeles. It's about OJ. But OJ really becomes almost this cipher that you use as a portal, you know, into investigating money, power, celebrity, race, you know, the legal system. So how did this project come to be?
ESPN approached me, a guy named Connor Schell, who is the who runs ESPN Films, and started. I don't mean to speak to you as if I've done a lot of research.
Right.
I was told by a friend of mine, that another mutual friend, Wyatt Cenac, that
yeah,
you're not a huge sports guy.
Right.
So my guess is you haven't watched a lot of sports documentaries that ESPN would have done. So they've done. He started this 30 for 30 series. They'd probably done 90 docs
over
the course of like 6 or 7 years.
As ambitious as yours?
No, not at all. And actually, the conversation was, we want to start doing more ambitious things.
Uh-huh.
So Connor came to me and he said, so we're interested in doing a, we're thinking about doing a 5-hour thing, 5-hour project.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I want to do a 5-hour film. That's what I want to do. And then it was, oh, but what is it about?
Right.
And he said, oh, it's about OJ. That's what we're thinking. And I was like,
really? Well, why, what was the first, what hit you immediately?
I was like, oh, what you want is the trial and going through the murder.
Shit.
Like,
right.
Yeah, it's like, which we all live through and has been talked about ad nauseum.
Right.
And what more can I say? What
right.
can I add to that conversation?
Sure.
And I happened to be coming out here the next day.
Right.
And I have a lot of friends out here, all of whom, you know, they're my friends. They know me pretty well. And I said, you know, ESPN asked me if I wanted to do this 5-hour thing about OJ. And they kind of were like, are you crazy? I think you need to do this because...
Just because of the opportunity? Or?
Thematically, it's about a lot of the things that you're interested in.
Like, what was your history?
I'll tell you in a second. And then
okay.
But basically, when I thought about it, it was the canvas of... It was the 5-hour thing that ended up being the determinant, because I realized that I didn't have to do the trial.
Right.
I could go back and explain the context, get into the history of Los Angeles, of the LAPD, get into OJ's time at USC, a dynamic I understood about him being a black kid coming from Potrero Hill, going to this lily white university that's super conservative, that's also next door to Watts,
right.
that had exploded in violence a year and a half before he came there. I already knew that. And so... If I could tell that story, then I'm in.
Right.
And so that's what got me, was the history, because I was a history major in college. This would have been like a huge American studies thesis.
Right.
And that's how I kind of approached it.
Right. It feels like that.
Yeah.
In a good way. You know, thesis sometimes is a word that people are like, what?
In fact, I still think I have dreams about somehow like having an assignment.
Like that
my senior
year
that I haven't even started. I was like, oh, I have to come up with an idea. And it's February, and it shit's due in March.
Well, what is your background personally and then, you know, in terms of film? So you're a history major, but where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Washington, D.C.
And what's your background?
Background how?
Like, what's your family like? You got a Jewish name.
I got a Jewish name. My father is one of those. He's a Jew. He's a Jew.
Yeah.
My mother is black. She's from South Carolina. My dad's a Jew from Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
So I grew up in a biracial household, multi-denominational household.
Uh-huh.
It comes through religion.
Uh-huh.
And I have two older brothers.
Uh-huh.
I come from a pretty serious family.
In what way?
Not a lot of jokes.
But what was the tone? Were they progressive? Were they...
My parents my parents... My mother was a civil rights lawyer in the South. She was the first black woman to pass the bar in Mississippi.
That's pretty.
She met my father, who was an aide for Robert Kennedy in Mississippi in 1967. So that gives you
are not only progressive.
What my family is.
Yeah, you're a legacy of the original civil rights progressives.
Yeah. And in fact, I think my parents were. It's debated. It just became debated, but until about 6 weeks ago,
uh-huh.
I always understood that they were the first couple after the Loving decision to get first interracial couple to be married in the state of Virginia.
Is that true?
Yeah. Well, I think now it might be third. My mother recently said, I think we might have been now third.
Now that you're older, the truth is
We were mythologized.
Something like that. Uh-huh. I've been trying to break down that mythology for my entire life. Uh-huh. And I was like, I knew it.
But so this thing that that you did with the OJ thing, I mean, I have to assume that even knowing the history, that once you got into it, once you started putting together some of the archival footage and the narrative, that it kept growing.
Oh, yeah. It kept growing. It went from the initial conceit, which was 5 hours for television.
Yeah.
Which would be, and you would know this better than I do, as you have a show with commercials on TV.
Right.
Whatever percentage of it. So it would be 4 hours and 20 minutes, whatever it would have been.
Right.
And because I had no greater understanding of how to make a 5 hour film as I would a 20 hour film, I just sort of went into it. And we amassed enough material, characters, interviews, footage, that as we were going through the process of editing, within a few months, I said to Connor, the aforementioned guy who commissioned the project in the first place, I said, you know, I think we need 5 hours, not 5 hours for TV. And then a month later, I said, I think we need 6 hours.
Yeah.
And he kept being like, fine.
Yeah.
I'll figure it out.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was our operating principle for the next few months. We got to cut what was an 11-hour cut down to 6.
Right.
Which seemed hard, but reasonable.
Wasn't it 7?
Well, no. Then we finally showed a rough cut. It was a little over 7.5 hours. We had a day where we went to a screening room in New York at ABC. Bunch of people. It was a long day. Came out of it. And Connor said, well, why don't we just make it 7.5 hours? And it ended up being at 7 hours and 44 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And so at that point, I couldn't have gotten it down to 6 hours. So I was like, yeah, that would be great.
Well, the fascinating thing about it, and I know there is historical precedent for singular documentaries being, you know,
what,
hours.
What, Showa?
Yeah, Showa.
Yeah, that's the precedent.
that's the only one.
Keep going. I challenge you. Keep going.
That was the only one I thought of, actually. Yeah, but I was protecting myself from looking stupid and thinking that there's got to be more than just Showa.
Yeah, no. Well, I've seen bits and pieces when I was a kid. So.
Right. But what, had you done docs before?
Yeah, I've done, this is my fifth. Oh, well, I had done 4 feature-length docs. I worked at HBO for 12 years.
Which ones did you do?
I did all sports docs. Mm-hmm. So I did a doc called Magic and Bird, mm-hmm. Courtship of Rivals, about Magic and Bird, basketball players. I did one about the Brooklyn Dodgers called The Ghosts of Flatbush.
Mm-hmm.
And one called The Curious Case of Curt Flood, about Curt Flood, who's a baseball player. He sued Major League Baseball in 1969 to be a free agent.
So you're a sports fan.
I am a huge sports fan.
And O.J. Simpson was probably a little before your time.
Just before my time. So he retired in 1979. I probably started watching sports in 1979.
But you knew about him.
Oh, yeah. He was a big part of my childhood.
He was.
I mean, mainly through watching him dodge people on Hertz commercials.
Right.
Which I would then do when I was in airports.
Dad or mom sports fans?
My dad was a sports fan. I think my dad, having 3 sons, I'm the youngest of 3. I think he was not the greatest athlete in the world.
Right.
And I think he had the wisdom to put a ball in all of our hands when we were young and said, go out there and play.
Yeah, yeah.
Be a better athlete than I ever could.
Oh, that's good.
And so we were all sort of, that's what we did.
So the interesting thing about OJ is that, and I don't know if you, I mean, you obviously know it, that, you know, as the narrative goes on and, you know, he's claiming to be above race and just a person, you start to realize that, you know, he's just about OJ. That he's trying to sort of, maybe not intentionally, present himself as racially progressive, whereas he's really completely narcissistic.
No, that's correct. He's not aggressively about race one way or the other. It's
right.
I'm about me, and I'm trying to do what I want to do, which is to be famous and to be loved and to be
right. But
rich.
It wasn't about dissolve the color line.
No, it wasn't like I don't like being black. It wasn't like I'm trying to, you know, make some statement about being race neutral.
Right.
It was more like, I'm on this path to this place. The way for me to get to that place is to not be outspoken about matters of race, to not be political and militant at a time where white America might sort of look at me and go, oh, I'm not.
But what was interesting, though, and if I'm remembering correctly, very few of his intimates, really, or the people that were even judging him who were black, called him a Tom.
No, I mean, and also, that's a loaded term. I mean, I look at, you know, I think that whether it's revisionist history or the way that we've tended to think about OJ,
yeah,
in the present is that he was that, and to be very dismissive of the choices that he made.
Uh-huh.
And I looked at it, especially when you look at him being 21 years old.
Yeah.
And I know what I was like when I was in college. Like, there's a lot put on him at that age. Mm-hmm. And that he came up and was that, just because he was a great athlete, all of a sudden there's this expectation, because you have this group of militant, strident guys who are over here saying, you have to be about this.
But including Muhammad Ali and Jim Brown and
oh, yeah. These were some serious cats. And yeah. By the way, they were the cream of the crop when it came to black athletes.
Yeah.
And this was like the Justice League.
Yeah.
Bill Russell, Lou Alcindor, even, who was OJ's contemporary across town at UCLA, was already political and talking about boycotting the 1968 Olympics. And so that was the climate that OJ arrived at, arrived in when he got to USC. But it's like now OJ's in this place where no one's political there.
Yeah.
No one's black there.
Right.
And everyone's kissing his ass because he's a football star.
And he detaches from it consciously, though.
He does do that. And so when Harry Edwards, who is the great, famous sociologist who was a professor at San Jose State at the time, organized something called the Olympic Project for Human Rights, and he was organizing athletes to potentially boycott the 68 yeah. games in Mexico City, he came to OJ because of his prominence as an athlete and wanted him to join the movement. And OJ said, famously, "I'm not black, I'm OJ."
Right.
And he was like, "I'm going to do me."
Yeah.
And that's not me.
Right.
You know, I'm going over here. And in the weird thing about OJ, especially the way that the space that he occupies in our culture now, I mean, before all this shit happened, he was a trailblazer. I mean, OJ took a path that went that way.
Yeah.
Said, "I want to be on TV and I want to hawk products and
yeah.
sign deals with Chevrolet and RC Cola before he'd ever play in the down in the NFL."
Yeah.
And I was fascinated by that. So in some ways, the one different story is OJ as this pioneering pitchman, this race-neutral, non-political black athlete, and he really begat Michael Jordan, who begat Tiger Woods.
Right.
And he set that paradigm.
Right.
And so, I mean, look, how much that has to do with the story? I mean, to me, it has to do with the story, because ultimately where we get to with his trial is the level of symbolism, in terms of him becoming this symbolic black figure.
Yeah.
The amount politically that people invested in him, it was this great irony.
Right.
And so that's what all of this is about, which is seeing this weird juxtaposition, seeing these ironies, and going like, of all people?
How did you break this up in your mind as an arc? When you saw the content you had, you've got, I imagine, three parts.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
How did you see them?
In fact, the film existed in three parts until the very late stage.
Literally three parts.
Literally until very late, right. late, which was essentially what encompasses now the first two parts. Everything leading up to the murders in June of 94, everything through the trial, including the verdict, and then everything after.
Right.
That's how it was sort of broken up in my mind. And even the way we had three editors working, they were working on those separate chunks.
Right.
And then when it became official that we were going to do, that it was going to be as long as it is, and then that, which meant, oh, they're going to do 10 hours of television ultimately, and they wanted us to break it up into five parts, I had to sort of figure out a mechanism to make it five parts versus three.
Right.
But the point being is that was kind of the structure in my head as far as the narrative. You know, the trickier part is where you're going to intercut in the first 3 hours the story of the LAPD and the community with OJ's story.
That was like fascinating for me, because I think I was politically detached at the time, and you know, arguably, you know, I remember the chase. I remember because I was doing a television show at the time. I remember it, you know, capturing the nation, but I did not get hung up on the trial.
I didn't either.
And I was detached from it. But that aside, the politics and the racially charged atmosphere of Los Angeles, the history of it was not something I knew.
Where were you at the time?
New York.
For
OJ? Yeah, yeah, I was in New York.
Do you remember actually watching the chase?
I do.
Where were you?
I was in the I was at HBO Downtown Productions. Hmm. What year was that?
94. June 94. June 17th, 1994.
Yeah, I feel like where I was in those offices where Short Attention Span Theater was.
Oh, okay.
When I was hosting that show, because I think I did that 93, 94-ish, but it, like, because I remember going in, they had TVs up, and I'm like, what's happening?
Right.
And that was that. I remember that.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken.
I mean, it's sort of a look, I've thought about this a lot. It's an interesting commentary that's this shared event that we all have as far as remembering where we were, and it's a television event.
Mm-hmm.
And it's honestly, it's not John Kennedy being assassinated. It's not Martin Luther King being assassinated. It's OJ in a white Bronco,
right,
on the 405.
Right. That's true.
And it's crazy.
Yeah. But like, I thought what was amazing about what you were able to sort of kind of bring together in some kind of, like, I imagine, not completely serendipitous way, but I could feel your what must have been your excitement at the sort of levels you were able to kind of engage.
Well, I mean,
just juxtaposing, by just montage.
Oh, yeah.
That you were able, like, I just could see, I almost think I felt your excitement as the thing grew into like this multi-level sort of, it's not even an expose, but it's sort of like a kind of like serendipitous investigation of everything that defines the media right now, the legal system, and race relations in this country.
No, there's definitely a sense that no matter what I'm doing in telling a story that took place in the past, I don't even need to talk about what's happening in the present. It's so connected.
Yeah, it's the birth of that predatory tabloid television. Once he sells out, celebrity culture in general.
Correct.
So they're all operating.
Oh, I think there's a very real sense, and it's hard to convey this in the doc, but, you know, if you follow OJ's trajectory, it is consistent with the trajectory of us in our culture.
Right.
As far as, you know, OJ chose this superficial path. He came up in the most substantial of times, and he became most famous in 1968, the most volatile year in 20th century America, arguably. And when you look at his fame, how he became famous, it's like there's this downward line that you can draw as far as how our culture has devolved.
Uh-huh.
And he's a wonderful lens to sort of explore that.
I'd not been privy to or morbidly fascinated with, to the point of compelling me to really take in that murder.
Good.
And you spend a lot of time, you know, doing that for us, and it's important to see how fucking savage.
Yes.
That thing was.
Yes.
Fucking savage.
I think the importance of that is, and frankly, I'm like you, I didn't engage with it that much either, if at all. But when you then look at what the trial became, and when you look at how everyone, the amount of people, by the way, in the media, in this city alone, who have come up to me and say, I put a pool in my house because of the OJ trial, you know, or I did that, you know, and you're like,
yeah,
do you know what happened?
Yeah. Do you see these pictures?
Like, you need to see this. And for all, you know, whoever wants to maintain a certain sort of like, I don't believe he's guilty, but, you know, maybe this happened, or maybe he knew he was somehow responsible. Like, oh, he might have known who was there, or he was there, there's someone else there, or whatever, dude. Just look at the pictures, and it forces you to engage with that crime and whatever level of complicity you believe he had. Because I don't think you can look at him the same way afterwards.
No, hell no. And just like that one detail of, like, you know, he went back to both bodies to cut some more. Whoever did it.
By the way, just tell me, what was, yeah, before you watch this, so like you said, you didn't watch you didn't care about the FX series. Before you watch this, what was, if someone said OJ, like, are you just like, I don't give a fuck about OJ. So did you just not engage with this at all? Did you have an opinion about
his when culture? I heard about your movie?
No, I'm just in general, the story. So like, say a year ago, someone was talking to you about OJ, would you just be like, yeah, I don't really, it's not for me, don't care.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say I wouldn't care. And I, you know, obviously I lean more towards the reality that, you know, that he did do it and was complicit. And as time goes on, that nothing else was revealed.
That would have changed your opinion.
Right. Yeah. That, you know, that you had to sort of take it for what it was. But the nuances of what you did in terms of, you know, even really realizing that whether he did it or not was not necessarily important to the people that were championing him.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I'm not talking about the lawyers.
Correct. That's correct. It's all, that is correct. I mean,
because when you document the history of injustice, racial injustice towards that community, and abuse and violence and death, that, you know, at some point it's like killing's not, you know, we see it all the time,
mm-hmm.
but we don't see it from this side,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And now, I mean, look, the complicated thing is you could believe that he's guilty. You could watch the film and say, I believe before and now I believe more than ever he's guilty. But I also may have been rooting for him to get off, or I actually believe he should have. Those are all, to me, rational responses to watching this because of that history. And there are very real mistakes that were made by the prosecution. The argument about, you know, proving something beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, the burden of proof is on the prosecution. And when you listen to the other juror, not Carrie Best, the younger juror, Yolanda Crawford,
yeah.
and she's very rational in her response to it. She listened to the evidence and she believed the prosecution fucked up. And that's why she chose, you know, to acquit OJ. And you go, yeah, it is more complicated in the way this has been reduced.
And the Goldman stuff was sort of fascinating because, you know, the pain of that family and the sort of crusade of that father, which, you know, as somebody who, you know, like is weirdly American and geared towards these narratives that are compelling, that, you know, during that, realizing that he became the annoying guy.
Oh, he was in some ways, he was Inspector Javert. Like, he was like out. That was, he was obsessed
right.
with getting OJ,
right.
with getting justice. But, and of course it's personal.
Yeah, it's his son.
I mean, and that's another fucked up thing. Like, how does the victim of this story become someone that you're looking at and you're like, dude, pull back a little bit? It's very sensitive, all of it. And it's very complicated. And it's made even talking about it very complicated because there's a sensitivity I feel like we all had, myself, producers, yeah. editors, and putting this together. Then all of a sudden, and you're not at all guilty of this, this is a wonderful conversation. But there are people who just want to boil things down to a certain essence.
Right.
And I'm like, no, I spent all this time doing not that. And I don't all of a sudden want you to say, so what do you really think about OJ? And I'm like, I don't,
no.
I just put all that out there. Think for your fucking
yeah,
self.
Yeah, well, that you're going to have to deal with that, you know, the horrible kind of like limited intelligence of the media community just by virtue of what they think they need to do is that you can't, there's no way you can really explain or render down what was achieved with the documentary. It's got nothing to do, you know, with anything in particular.
That's correct.
Like in the sense that, you know, you can't, because the conversation, when you start having it about it, you know, it's like, cause people go like, so what'd you learn about OJ? It's like, it's not really about OJ specifically. You know, it is very particular in what it focuses on, but what it implies and what it implicates and, you know, what it sheds light on and the questions that it poses are very big and broad and multi-faceted.
More so than any, this is a story that demands no judgment.
Right.
This is a story that demands, like, I'm going to talk to as many people that come from all sides and just let them say their piece.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here to hear you, and then I'll put it together in a way that sort of is fair to everybody.
Yeah.
And then the viewer can decide.
Did you reach out to him?
Yeah, I wrote him a email. They have something called jail mail. I wrote them as long as there's a certain amount of characters you're afforded.
Yeah.
And I went up to the limit, never heard back. I waited a long time because it's not as if this whole project was contingent upon whether OJ participated or
right.
not. And it's not as if OJ is not on the record saying what he has to say
right.
for all time. And I waited until I was done with all my interviews. And I said, look, man, I'm doing this thing. I've interviewed 72 people from all across the spectrum. I didn't want to reach out to you until I had done my homework. I've done my homework. I know you've not done an interview since you've been in jail, but if you would be willing to grant me a half hour interview, I'll take it. If you want to sit with me for a whole day, I'll take that. A whole week, whatever you want.
Nothing.
Crickets.
Really?
Didn't bother me.
No. Why should it? I mean, like you said, it was not necessary.
It was not necessary. And I don't believe that he would have been the most forthcoming of interview subjects.
Well, the only thing that would have been interesting about it is how he handled it. I mean, I wouldn't expect him to be forthcoming at all, but how would he work it?
Well, that's, I mean, in the end, it's like if you're someone who enjoys interviewing people
yeah.
and you get to interview OJ
sure.
Simpson,
no, I get that.
I'd be right. like, oh, please, I would right. like that challenge.
And now, so like the life of the thing is now on ESPN, and I know you showed it in some theaters.
It was released in the theaters for a week in New York.
For Oscar consideration?
Yes, to qualify right. for awards.
Right.
Having said that, it was at Sundance.
Yep.
They played the whole thing at Sundance and Tribeca.
In one sitting?
Yeah. Oh, no. They played it in two parts at Sundance. They played the first three parts in one sitting. We had a break, and they played the last two. At Tribeca, it was one long day. They had intermissions after part two, intermissions of part four.
How was it received?
It was great. Yeah. I mean, the day at Tribeca, especially because it was consistent, no one left the theater.
Yeah.
And so it turned into this very communal thing where mm-hmm. people come out intermission and talk about what they'd seen, and they went back for more. I do think you clearly have to prepare yourself if you're going to a movie theater.
For 7 hours, sure.
Yeah, it's like it's light at the beginning and it's dark when you leave. But I, you know, for me, it made me realize that as much as I conceive this as one story and one documentary, which I did, you know, I'm also smart enough to know that who the fuck has time to sit and watch something for 7 hours and 45 minutes. But that people responded and sat in their chairs and were actually engaged made me realize, no, this is actually how it should be seen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who the fuck doesn't want their movies shown in the theater?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and so like when I've been out here for a few weeks and it was playing at the Lemley's in Santa Monica. And I popped in because it's great to just like check it out and
sure.
see. And so that was a trip for me. Yes, there's this, you know, it was put in the theater for that reason.
No, I mean, I wasn't trying to get you defensive.
You know, you'd be allowed. That's fine. I'm uncomfortable with the whole thing. It's fine.
I understand.
I just like having my movie in theaters.
Why wouldn't you? And it deserves to be in theaters, and this should make you comfortable. I thought it was incredible. It was completely provocative, completely engaging, jarring, educational. It made you confront your own sense of morality and self, and you know who you were in relation to this information and this event or series of events. Good stuff, man.
Thank you, Mark.
I'm telling you, folks, it's not just about OJ. You got to watch this thing. It'll blow your mind. Also, if you're a business owner, your company is only as good as the people you hire. Posting jobs in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. And if you have a small business like I do, you don't have time to post on dozens of job sites. ZipRecruiter is the solution. You can post to more than 100 job sites with a single click. That includes social media sites like Facebook and Twitter. The job you're looking to fill will be instantly matched to candidates from more than 6 million resumes. That's insane. And ZipRecruiter sets you up with an easy-to-use system that allows you to track the new candidates as they roll in within 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. And right now, listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/Marin. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Marin. Go try it for free and get staffed up, folks. You got it? All right. Underground comics, as I used to call them when I was a kid, were some of my first portals into the grown-up world, into the world of sex, into the world of drugs, into the world of just basic neurotic insanity. When I was young, when I was in junior high, seeing R. Crumb stuff, the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers, all the Zap stuff, seeing how a penis actually went into a vagina, the actual logistics of it. Saw that first in an underground comic. And part of the legacy of these original underground comic artists, obviously, moving through Zap and through Fantagraphics. This guy, who I'm about to talk to, Daniel Klaus, is really, really one of the greatest. And his most recent graphic novel is called Patience. You can get that wherever you get books or through Fantagraphics.com. So right now, I'm going to engage with the genius that is Daniel Klaus. So your dad went to India and he came back. Yeah, I don't know. Why did he go?
It was like somebody he was working with had some deal going on there.
And the India
some,
deal.
It was some shady deal that my dad was involved in.
What did he do? That guy,
my dad, he was a really brilliant guy who got a PhD in engineering, from the University of Chicago, and then accidentally got my teenage mom pregnant, and had to go work in the steel mill. So he was one of the, like, a, he was like a character out of a movie, like super smart guy working in the steel mill.
Yeah, just a guy that one misstep.
One frat house party, you know, gone too far.
That was it?
My mom, yeah, my mom lived two doors away from the frat house.
And she wandered over.
I don't know. I don't want to know the detail.
Really?
I do not want
to. So, like, he was on a trajectory to be an engineer, and then he's like, yeah. Well, now I got responsibility.
Now I'm at the steel mill.
Now I'm a family yeah. man.
Right.
And that's where he did his work all the way through.
Steel yeah, mill? No, my parents divorced. They were like the vanguard of divorced parents. You know,
what year was this?
62. I was born in 61. They waited one more year.
Yeah.
I once asked my mom, like, why was I born? Like, you guys were, like, just really arguing and stuff. And my mom said, you know, we used, like, four different kinds of birth control. And I was like, all right. Like, I was, like, the little guy who made it through.
Yeah. Persistent.
Exactly. Yeah. So they just, you know, they got divorced. And then he quit the steel mill. And then, random things guy? He was a brilliant guy. He wanted to make his own stuff. So at one point he made his own race car that was at the highest level that actually was like raced in NASCAR
yeah.
type races.
Really?
Yeah.
He built a race car
like from scratch. Like,
so you would go over there and there'd be cars and parts and things up on lifts?
Well, it's very my mom left him mm-hmm. for his driver. He built the car and he had a guy who was like his driver races and she left him for the driver. She and the driver opened a garage that repaired foreign cars on the south side of Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
And then the driver, my stepdad, died in a race in like 1966 when I was 5 years old. So my mom is now like running a shop on the south side of Chicago.
An auto repair shop.
Yeah. So my whole childhood is cars.
Grease.
Yeah, grease. I don't even know how a car works. I was just like, it's like, you know, if your dad's an accountant, you're like, I don't care.
Oh, so you get like just those steel drums full of oil?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was all that.
The rags, the tools. You know, yeah. Dubious men.
Very dubious men. It was... it was a lot of, you know, like I mean, I have a childhood memory of like eating like a giant, you know, some kind of wire that was used for, you know, some kind of repair thing. And I was like, Mom, I ate this wire. And they're like, oh, shit.
You ate the wire.
Yeah, now we have to go to the hospital. Kid ate the wire.
Did they get it out?
No, I think it's still in there. It's like
lodged.
Shows up in the
part of the biology.
The screening, yeah.
Well, yeah, I had a grandfather who owned a hardware store, and there was always this crew of men, you know, these old dudes hanging around talking about stuff. And it was like, I always was very impressed.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they all seem to have lives. It's a weird thing about having people that do those kind of professions in your life or just have those kind of, you know, dudes around.
Who know how to do like practical things.
Yeah.
Where,
yeah.
Like, no, you don't. You use like the duct tape for the pipe fittings.
Exactly.
And, you know.
Is that soldered?
What? Right. And you're like, can you do it?
when you're an adult and you have a home, you know, you start to be taught that stuff and you're like, I had no idea that's how when you just put basic plumbing, you gotta have that tape, that silicone tape in there, so it'll seal it.
Right.
And it's like a miracle to you.
I'm only finally at the age where I sort of get like, oh yeah, your house has all these pipes and tubes and like, it was just a miracle before that. So you plug it in and it works.
Right.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
And now I'm like, oh, there's like the wiring that somebody figured that out.
They figured that out. Not only that, when something goes wrong, when you own your own house, there's that moment like, I hope someone fixes it.
Exactly. It's like, where's the landlord? Yeah,
shit, that's me.
God damn it.
Where do you... I keep looking at these trees as they start. It's going to take a branch to enter my home before I'm like, I guess I got to
call a tree trimmer
to come do that.
Right.
Yeah. Well, where did you? So you grew up all in Chicago?
I grew up on the south side of Chicago. Yeah.
So you're a Chicago guy all through.
Well, now I consider myself a Californian. I've been here 24 years.
But Chicago's like only in recent
years have I grown to appreciate that that is one of the great cities that has its own tone, its own sort of sense of identity. Like, there aren't that many cities that have that in this country.
True. Yeah, it's true.
But, like, Chicago is definitely its own thing, and yeah. the people that come from there are Chicagoan.
Yeah. And, no, it's, you can, I mean, I often I'll, like, be out here in California and hear somebody's voice and I'll go like, what part yeah. of Andersonville in Chicago did you grow up? You know, you yeah. can pinpoint it.
You grew up, you're 2 years older than me, so we kind of had the same stuff coming at us in a way, culturally. Yes. Did you have brothers and sisters?
I have a older brother. That was what caused my parents to get married.
Oh, he was the guy. What's the age difference?
He's 10 years older.
Oh, so you had a portal. You had a portal in.
Yes.
That guy was well into it.
Oh, yeah. He got all the brunt of it. I escaped, you know.
But you had, like, you had the, if he was, so 10 years older, so that means, like, so you're born 61, so
he's
51,
yeah.
So you, right. So, like, by the time the late 60s come around, you were living with it.
Oh, yeah, completely.
Then what a gift.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Because, like, there's something about, like, you know, when I read, like, going through your stuff, like, I have not been, I was compulsive about graphic novels and about, you know, the world of comics that you come from, you know, years ago.
Sure.
Like, I read The Eight Ball.
Sure.
And I read, you know, Bag, and I read Burns, and, like, you know, all the guys that were doing that stuff. And I was a Crumb fan to a certain extent, obviously, when I was a kid, but sure. I kind of missed that.
Right.
But so it was all very important to me. So I'm going through this stuff, like, you know, looking at Eight Balls again. I'm like, I read all this once.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, like, you
it's
know,
a, it's a
part of my
capsule.
Life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the new book is great. The new novel is great. I don't know how to refer to them. Is it a graphic novel
yeah,
or novel?
Yeah, we hate that word, but we use it.
The graphic
yeah,
novel?
Yeah, it's a graphic novel.
What would you rather call it?
See, that's a problem. We all like, oh, that word is stupid.
It's a
but
comic?
Then we can't come up with a better. Yeah, I would just say a comic. But
right.
But then people think it's the, you know, the floppy kind of comic. So
right.
I don't care. I don't care. It's like, you know, in a way, it's good we don't have a good word. You know, once you have a word that defines you, like my generation of comics, we weren't underground. We never had a good word for us. So that's why we can still do comics. If we had a name for us, like the postmodernists, or,
right, right,
we'd be done. We'd just like, oh, they were done, you know.
Right, it's over.
But we have no name.
But when you started, I never came to comics through Marvel or through any of
right.
that shit. It was not my means of escape. I just
right.
didn't have it. So when I came into comics, when I was in junior high, it was like a rack at a head shop. So it was, there
yes.
was that, you know, the rack of, yeah. You know, the Freak Brothers,
right.
Crumb,
right. Dope comics
and all High Times in the back.
Yeah.
And I used to love, Lampoon, the stuff that they used to run.
Absolutely.
You know, Von Bode, is that his name?
Yep.
And, who was the other guy that did the weird ones? That it wasn't Gahan Wilson, but there was another dude who had a real vibe to him in Lampoon. I can't remember. That stuff just, you know, blew my mind.
Yeah, that was my big influence, all that stuff.
Yeah, like who specifically? And when?
National Lampoon, you know, there's a woman named M.K. Brown. Who
That's her.
Yeah, she's incredible.
That shit was like the best.
Yeah, she was so unappreciated and just like so ahead of her time.
I didn't even know it was a woman.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's the
yeah,
one.
M.K. Brown, yeah. She
did those
around.
Weird kind of float. They were almost, all the characters almost
yeah, they're
seemed
always
like
kind
they're floating.
Floating. And they
yeah.
have this really beautiful dialogue and it's like a Beckett play or
right,
something.
Right,
really
right.
good.
What was her story?
She, you know, was a big deal when Lampoon came around, and then when Lampoon ended, all these great artists there was nowhere to go. You know,
yeah.
like my world of comics hadn't been invented yet. So
right.
there was the undergrounds, and they weren't quite that. You know, they were
right.
they were not in that, so they didn't ever fit into that world. So they just all wound up doing like children's books, things like that. You know, just illustrations, things like that. There was
it's,
no world.
It's interesting to me that there is that once you learn this craft.
Yeah.
The craft of art and layout and all that stuff,
yeah, yeah.
that on some level, a lot of comic artists are designers to a degree, right?
You gotta be everything. You
graphic
be
artist.
15 different things to do it.
So, like, it's just interesting that, you know, if you have an outlet like you have, or like M.K. Brown did in the 70s, where you can really express yourself and create a tone and, you know, deal with existential issues, you know, which seems to be the real theme of underground comics.
Pretty
you know,
much, yeah.
Outside of drugs and pirates and space travel.
Right.
that, you know, I think what the guys at Zap laid down was sort of a template, right?
Sure.
In Mad Magazine.
Mad certainly was the beginning of it all.
Right. And, but like MK Brown, like the thought that she could just go and do greeting cards or children's books.
Right.
It's like, but what about the great
what about
floating
all that
weirdness?
Stuff? Yeah, I know. Where, bring it back.
Yeah. So when did you realize it? Cause you're in this environment where you're hanging out at, what, auto repair shops and what
do you sitting on the floor. I was
parts around.
That was the beauty of having the 10-year older brother is that he just, you know, he became a hippie and it's like, here's my comics. He just like left me. I moved into his room when he.
But like, what kind of hippie
home.
Was he, like a peace and love hippie or just hippie?
He was a drug hippie. he was way, you know, way into the world of it. You
so
know?
It was so, like, there, cause there was that, like, you know, there was the invention of the hippies, which actually had, right. Social purpose, and right. Then there was everyone well, we can fuck and smoke pot and do acid.
I never heard any of the peace and love.
No, it was just rock and roll.
It was just like, all right, I can, you know.
Was he like a good guy or a bad guy?
He's a good guy. He's a good guy. But
still
around? He's still around, but it was, you know, he had a lot of tough years because of that era. And just
what happened?
Just, you know, he got into drugs and stuff, you know, and it was just like, you know, my parents were... They were the proto 70s parents who were just like, it's, you know, live on the street and, you know, live life and, you know,
they were supportive of it in a way.
yeah, in a way. Like, they were just not, they didn't
hands off.
They were hands off. They were hands in a way. You know, now that I'm a parent, you know, it's like for years I just thought, that's fine. And then now I look back and all the parents of that era and they're like, what the fuck were they doing?
No, they were, my parents were the same way because whatever they came from or whatever they thought it was supposed to be had shifted.
Right.
So they were in this identity crisis as adults.
Like, what do we do? Yeah. And they were like, we got to like divorce and get married.
And find ourselves.
And just
everyone can party now.
It was.
You mean we can just have sex and get divorced?
Yeah, kids will be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. They're all right.
They're okay. Look
at them.
They're happy.
Right. He dressed himself. Let him go outside.
Oh, man.
Because, like, there was, like, that element of sort of, like, I remember when I was a kid, you just wandered, and it was okay. But, like, when I was 8, like, I'm going to take the bus to the thing.
Yeah, it's, like, 4 buses to the comic store.
Right.
And I'd get, all the time, get, like, beaten up, and just all kinds of horrible things happen to me that if it was my son, I'd be horrified.
You wouldn't let your kid get on a bus?
Never.
At 11?
Never.
At 11 years old or whatever?
I would turn myself into the police if I ever did that.
But you could do it when we were kids. It's weird because on some level, the environment was...
It was even worse then, too. It was more dangerous.
It was worse, but I don't know. The kind of isolation and moral bankruptcy that is upon us because of, you know, technological advances has become problematic. There's a lot of people sitting at home looking at things all day long that they shouldn't, and it does have an effect.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, they go out into the world and they're like, I'm still in the thing.
Yeah, right. I'm in the shooting game.
Yeah. Or whatever it is.
Right.
I believe that it does sort of, you know, fuck you up.
Especially when virtual reality hits, we're going to be in such a scary world.
People are going to be wandering around
just
with their glasses
on. Just like still in the...
Well, there's something to do that because, like in thinking about... Those early comics, like this stuff, you know, that Crumb was doing my experience with those Zap comics was, and I've talked about this a little bit before, that's the first time I saw sex. This is the first time I understood how it worked, where it went
I don't know if they had it right.
I'm not talking about intimacy and love, but the apparatus.
No, I mean, just even that part, it was like, what the hell am I looking at?
There was one panel that I remember in the, I went out and bought the book. It was The History of Underground Comics. The B. Dalton Booksellers.
Yes, I remember that.
And there was I think it was Spain Rodriguez piece in the middle where it was a cosmos thing. It was like just two.
I know what you're talking about.
They're connected. They're fucking. Yeah. That's where it goes. Like that.
I got it.
But it blew my mind. I mean, it like changed me forever.
I remember learning the word blowjob from a S. Clay Wilson comic
and
going like, what is that? Like, you know, of course you go like, why would you blow? Staying up all night. Like, what the fuck?
It took a lot of clearing up.
And asking all my friends and they're like, I have never heard that.
And then there was the one idiot that never had one, but said that they do blow, you know?
right.
And you're like, what? Really? And made up some story. Yeah. It really feels really good.
Yeah.
It blows bubbles.
It's happened to me many times. Yeah. Even though I'm 11,
But like you had all these like, you know, you must have like weird hippie girls and freaks coming into the house all the time, just wandering around.
Literally, I'd be like home reading my DC comics and like a naked man would just wander through my room. It was that kind of world.
Lost
like
on
a
acid.
Strange naked man.
Yeah, he's lost because he no longer knows where the room down the hall is.
I have this vivid memory of my brother and all his friends really stoned watching Leave It to Beaver in reruns. It'd be like 1969 or so. And every word that was said on the show, they were like, like just cracking up. And I was like, why is that funny? You know, it's like, they're just yelling at Eddie or what, you know, it's not funny. And they were just like cracking up.
And that's when you knew something else was happening.
And when I knew, like, I don't want to ever use drugs.
Yeah, oh, that really? Did, and you didn't?
Never did.
Because of that. Because
well, I had a lot of other experiences that made me think, like, I don't want to, like, relinquish my brain power.
Right.
Because I really saw it affect people in ways that made them unpleasant.
Yeah. So, but it's sort of interesting, too, that, like somehow or another, the way, even in your early artwork, that there was something, that the time, the tone of the time that you created, even in its surrealness, was something not nostalgic, but definitely not psychedelic. Seems to be rooted in almost a 50s motif. Is that possible?
I was certainly, yeah. I mean, I think I was so kind of traumatized by the 60s and growing up in that world that I was like, I want to go back to like 1961, right before it all fell apart and rethink life from that point on. I really think
that was a conscious decision.
I think it's sort of unconscious, but when I look back on my work, it's very clear that's what I was doing. I was like going back before all the craziness hit my life to try to like, okay, let's say everything was fine and we lived a normal life from that point on.
Well, that makes a lot of sense because what that did, and I was noticing this morning, what that did is it put a lot of weight on the characters to carry the weirdness of humanity that they were,
I feel guilty about
it. Well, if you had these settings and you had these people that were sort of dressing even in bits and pieces of different eras,
trying
to make sense of the identity you were creating for them. Right. But underneath it was usually this kind of, it's not carbuncled, but there was an awkwardness to everyone in their attempts to put themselves together.
And I think you're right. They're all going, why did he make me do this?
What did he say? He set me up.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a chess piece. It's like, why are you putting me out in the middle of the board?
Just to mock me.
I'm going to be crushed immediately.
It was hard enough when I was just a thought.
That's right. But look, now I have to wear this.
Well, do you ever, like, do you think about where, outside of, the Crumb influence that, that sort of window into humanity where, the weight of discomfort is personified all the time. Is that something you manifest because of yourself? I'm just talking, thinking out loud.
I bore that myself. I was trying to get out all the, all the inner turmoil that I had on, hoping I could exercise it in some way. Of course, that never works. It's not...
Right.
Art is not good therapy at all.
You don't think so?
I don't know. How do you find it is? Like,
well, problem with art being therapy is that, once you resolve some of the fundamental issues that needed relief, then you're in a pattern. So when the next sort of turn has to happen for you personally, the courage required to do that is harder than it was when it was desperate.
Yeah,
does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Because, it's like saying to you, this new book, Patience, is great. It seems to be a lot of what you were working towards, and all the themes are there, including a more sort of thorough science fiction element.
That's debatable.
Well, no, I'm not saying that it was technologically possible.
Okay.
But as a real thread through the theme of the book, I don't know that I'd seen that before, but, you've done a lot of work that I'm sure I missed. But if someone were to say to you, like, why don't you do a thing about your kid and, in the life at home?
Right.
You're like, ugh.
Oh, to live that.
Yeah. I need to get out.
I could do it, but I would have to make it about something that's not that at all.
Right.
You know?
Oh, that's right.
You know,
sublimate. Is that it?
Sublimate it. You sure?
Yeah. But at the beginning, this story, the idea that, cause like almost it's a theme on this podcast where, you know, I talk about, you know, who guided you, the older brother you know, that you were able at that point to say, like, I'll take the comics, but not the rest of this.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Even the music to some degree was sort of like, because it's usually about music where you're kind of like, thank God for the records. But but it seems like you sort of turned your back on the 60s thing.
Completely turned my back on all that.
Because it was too chaotic? What do you think?
Too chaotic. And, well, in the comics that I was left in that room were, I felt, and I didn't figure this out till years later, but I felt like this is like the weird record of the bad years that I missed. You know, I missed all the bad years with the parents that my poor brother had to endure.
Uh-huh.
And that, all those comics were from those 10 or 12 years. And I thought, that's not something we're ever going to really talk about.
That was his ticket out, you thought. Like, this is how he got relief.
Well, it was almost that, but it was also like, here's the story that you missed in these comics.
And
I would read these comics. This is before I could read, actually.
Yeah.
I'd read the comics and I would look at them and they were all just these weird 60s comics where all this crazy stuff is happening and the images are all, you know, they were comics done by like guys with PTSD who'd come out of World War II and they're just filled with crazy.
Like what?
You know, like just like, a lot of similar stuff to in my book, Patience, where there's people whose like flesh is exploding and just
crazy
dysmorphia and stuff that's, you know, they're just the guys hacking out comics. They're not thinking about it. But this is coming from their psyche. And it was something about like it was an expression of this like post-war PTSD, these characters who were our dads basically drawing these. And it's what led to like my brother being a hippie, you know, is like that kind of disconnect.
Right,
the next generation is like, I don't want to be like these cranky old men who are lost in their own weird world.
Yeah.
I want to be free and love and no war and none of that, you know. And, And so the comics feel to me like this perfect expression of that.
Like a tormented generational cry for help that couldn't be articulated.
Thank you.
Do you remember specific images and stuff that like that kind of blew you away and said like, you know, this is how I want to express myself?
So there's so many, I mean, you can't even articulate, you know, just there were images like where Superman would turn into like a devil and have an evil, devilish sneer. And, and you know, like I remember there's one where Jimmy Olsen, Superman's pal, has this contraption he puts on his head that's called the Helmet of Hate. And he becomes like this hate monger, Hitler type guy.
Yeah.
And just stuff like that. You know, who could think of that? But
so those are almost like they're almost passing moments. Like, you know,
it could be like one panel. It's all one panel. It's not the stories themselves are all cobbled together, but those single panels where you're like, what the fuck?
Right. And that could have been one of that guy's, the artist's bad days.
Yes.
You know, so you were extrapolating, you know, emotionally these moments that didn't quite add up and that were too, you know, surreal and aggressive to really make any sense on some level.
But that had, you know, more power, more visceral impact than like any
the story
any other work of art, though. That like as individual things hit me like, oh my, you know, wow.
Yeah.
This is right. Because this guy is not quite aware of what he's doing. He's just sending this straight from the back of his reptile brain onto the page into my little brain. There's one guy I got really obsessed with in the last couple of years who, this guy named Bob Powell, who did these horror comics in the 50s. And every single one of them practically is about some creepy little like homunculus guy who's like a mad scientist or like a normal scientist.
Yeah.
Who's got a beautiful, distant, icy assistant, like a female assistant. And he's trying to create some creepy monster to either like imprison her or impress her.
Yeah.
And of course she's just like repelled by him to the very end. And then he just destroys her with this like wall of flesh or whatever. And just every story is like that. And you're like, why wasn't this guy arrested?
But when you made all these assumptions,
wait a minute.
what you were experiencing and how you historically contextualized it, that, you know, that this was a generational thing and that comics were different and these guys.
And to be clear, I did not think of this at 8 years old.
No, I know. But did you, have you gotten any sort of validation on that? Have you met some of these guys, or did you learn more about them? And
Oh yeah. And you know, a lot of them weren't. Like, some of them were GIs. You know, some of them really saw like heavy duty combat.
Yeah.
A lot of them didn't. A lot of them, you know, were wimpy artists
right.
who got out of it somehow. But just that generation.
Sure.
You know, even the guilt of not doing that, I think.
And that's interesting. The sort of like the strange, you know, noise of humanity that gave birth to the 60s wasn't just a political thing, that there was something teeming at the core of that. And now that you talk about it, how could it not?
Of course.
I mean everybody's just sort of like the greatest generation. Could you imagine being at fucking D-Day? Or like at any, like, you know, taking one of those beaches, like just.
Well, and it's not like you'd just come home and be like, I'm now a normal dad in the 50s. You'd just be so, and couldn't talk to anybody.
PTSD
about
has existed since warfare. It just wasn't right. diagnosed as that. It's like he's right. a little shell shocked, you know, he's like, he's right. talking to the curb, you know, like it's like the culture just absorbed it somehow.
Right. And I realized at a certain point, all the stuff I'm sort of drawn to comes out of that. Like film noir is obviously that.
Right.
You know, the guys coming back and they're these haunted, broken men.
Right.
You know, and that so clearly leads to the 60s which leads to my thing, you know.
So you were able to sort of like, so that's interesting because in the way you're talking about it and the way that you constructed some of the early comics, that there was an element of time travel that happened all at once, that you had these characters that were seeking an identity,
right?
You know, outside of the 60s and part of the 50s, like, because I think that, like, you know, Ghost World and 8Ball to some degree actually helped define what became post-punk culture in a way. Yeah, on a fashion
right,
level.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
sure,
you didn't see a lot of that. Like, you probably are somewhat responsible for young, you know, women who shopped at thrift stores to decide that those glasses that their grandmothers wore were right. like, oh, these are pretty cool.
Well, certainly they existed, but I think I gave them the character that they'd be like, oh yeah, that's my right. my identity is in that realm.
You made them feel less alone, and then more people did it.
Right. Now Warby Parker is making a fortune.
Yeah, they are. I've advertised them. So where did you learn how to do the craft?
That was all, you know, trial and error, really. When I was about 13, maybe first year of high school, I realized I don't have any friends. What am I going to do? So I was like, I guess I'll stay home in my room and draw comics all day. That was my way of communicating with the world, even though nobody read them.
Right. But did you feel like, because I imagine being in high school at that time, what are we talking about? The early 70s?
Yeah, 73.
We were just all, you know, bell bottoms and rock and roll.
Yeah.
And like, you know,
I was
like
very alienated.
Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I hated all that stuff so much.
Really?
So much. So much. I was like the guy punk was made for because it was destructive of all the stuff I hated. Not that I even really liked.
Do you remember when that happened? When you got your first punk record?
Well, I remember when I learned about it. There used to be a TV show that was every like third week instead of Saturday Night Live. There was a show called Weekend with Lloyd Dobbins in the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. Nobody remembers this. And he had an episode about like the punk rock scourge of England. And I watched it and I was like terrified. I was like, oh my God, these people are horrible. You know what? Horrible, horrible monsters. And then like 2 weeks later, I was like, I kind of want one of those records. Like all of a sudden it seemed really appealing to me. And that's what got me into it.
Well, it's the same. It seems like the same fascination that you got from those comics that where you were able to see past the terrifying into this
right.
kind of like, no, this seems pretty reasonable.
Maybe I should join them.
And do you remember the first punk record?
It was the first Ramones record.
Oh.
Yeah.
That did it?
Yeah.
And you're like, ah, finally, I have a voice.
But I never, the trouble was that's still my favorite one. Like, I never found anything I liked as much as that. I spent like 5 years like, okay, there's going to be another, you know, and that was.
No,
they were the best and nobody else came close.
But you were able to, did you at least, when you were going home and making your comics, what were those about? Were they attacks on, was it you teaching a lesson to those who roam the halls?
There were some of that. There was, you know, I'd do really mean caricatures of my teachers and stuff like that. And One year we had this like big art show in school where you're supposed to show your art on the school walls. And so I cut out all my mean drawings of teachers and students and glued them on this big piece of cardboard and turned that in. And it was like in the era of the 70s where all the teachers had to go like, that's really great. You're really creative. But then like from then on, all my grades like plummeted.
Really?
Like, they were literally like, everybody's like, fuck him, you know, but they had to be really supportive. Like, your drawings are great.
I love that. That it was that there was an element of that you were fueled by a certain spite.
Yeah. Well, and I kind of was gaming the system. It's like I knew everybody'd have to be supportive, and it was exactly the kind of thing they didn't want anybody to ever do.
You know,
they just wanted like your photos of flowers.
So you get to laugh the sinister laugh of a guy that won.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. won a hollow victory that led to nothing.
No, are you kidding? It led to you realizing the power of the comic.
Maybe so. Maybe so.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. Well, I noticed that about like even when you watch the Crumb documentary that Zweigoff did, and you went on to work with him, but that there was he's such a a quiet, thoughtful, incredibly brilliant, festering guy,
right?
And he was able just to destroy the world.
Sure.
With his comics.
Oh, yeah.
And that.
He was a very passive aggressive guy, too. And he was able to become just purely aggressive in a way.
Yeah. And just do it all.
Yeah.
And actually change the way people looked at shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's an amazing, outlet.
It's a feat. Yeah.
So where did you, learn to do art? I mean, did you left Chicago, right? And you went.
I went to art school, but I can't say I really learned how to do art there. I learned it from studying other artists and just copying and doing, just working.
Where'd you go to art school? New York?
I went to Pratt in New York, yeah.
For the full run?
Yeah, full run. Back, I had a scholarship, and so it was literally just like, well, here's a 4-year break in my life where I don't have to get a job.
From Chicago to New York, did you love New York?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the main reason I went to art school, because I could not wait to go to New York.
What year was that?
79.
All right, so it was before it got, it was still kind of dirty and horrible.
It was still taxi driver-ish.
Yeah.
First time I was like, I'm going to go to Times Square, and I got out and got mugged within like 5 minutes.
Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah, guy just like immediately saw I was such a rube.
Look, there's the Midwest.
There's the kid, with the open stare, looks like he's 14, gawking at the, porn theater.
Yeah.
Guy just immediately came over and was like, give me your tokens. I was like, I don't have any tokens. I just got
tokens.
Yeah,
for
subway.
The subway
token. Yeah.
Oh, the old subway tokens.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what were you able to get, go see the Ramones?
I did. Yeah.
Was that great?
Yeah, it was great. Yeah, it was mind-boggling.
Were at CBGB's?
No, it was at Irving Plaza. Yeah, they weren't. They were bigger by 79. They were too big for that.
Did you go to a lot of shows?
Yeah.
Did you become part of that culture a bit?
No, I was always too solitary and contrary to. I would any scene I was involved in, I would become like, contrary within that scene. So then I became, it's you winnow yourself down to having no possibilities, basically.
What do you track that to?
I don't know.
That
behavior. It's a good policy, I think.
You don't have to deal with other people's expectations or needs or like judgment.
I remember as a kid, like I was a huge baseball fan as a kid, but my dad would never take me to a game. And I was just, I want to go to a game really bad. So finally, when I was like 12, my dad took me to a Cubs game in Chicago, and I couldn't have been more excited. And I got there, and then all the people around me were just these like drunk fat guys. And I was like, oh, I don't want to be part of this community. Like, I just remember thinking, like, oh, I don't want to ever go to a game again. Like, it was just such a letdown.
Well, that's interesting because so many, and this is like, I mean, an easy connection, but so many of your characters are kind of pathological outsiders. They're just, they're kind of like, emotionally or physically, hobbled in terms of like having any chance to integrate.
Yeah.
Into society.
Those are my people.
How does that happen? How do you develop a relationship with these characters once you kind of summon them?
Well, that's the hard part. I mean, I have to spend a lot of time with them before I ever draw them.
And is that true? Really?
Yeah. Once they emerge kind of unbidden, it's almost just like they're conjured from the flames or something. And you have this character, you know what they look like. You kind of know what their vibe is. But then all of a sudden, the more you think it over, the more you think it through, they start to come alive. And then when you start to draw them, then they really are like a they have to be real. Like, I have to feel like I'm transcribing these real people's lives.
Does your relationship with the characters, once you build it, determine how much they're going to show up or how much you commit to them?
It's really, you know, what good are they to me? You know, are they going to keep me entertained? Are they going to have an interesting story? You know, I want to draw characters just doing like brushing their teeth for no reason. You know, I want them to be in their most dramatic, interesting moments.
And there's something about the way, like, I think you and the ones that I really noticed, and I think it's because I grew up at the same time as you, and that there was, and I can't really put my finger on it because there's a poetry to it that is hard to describe, but, you know, is his name Charles Burns?
Charles Burns, yeah, sure.
That, you know, that those, the black hole stuff.
Yes.
That there's an area of creepiness and moral slipperiness.
Yes.
To just, it's almost like a townie thing.
Right.
That there's an element to these people that they don't look like they live in cities. They don't look like they live in anywhere, but they're completely relatable in the sense that it almost all feels like when you see somebody that is resonating something, even if they're just walking by you.
Sure.
That you're like, oh, that's all
it has a vibe. Yeah.
And that you guys seem to live in that vibe. And to some degree.
I'm certainly very aware of those people in the real world. You know, you see somebody in the airport that just has this singular vibe to them, and you immediately are like, okay, this guy is one of my characters. I feel that all the time, and like I could project into him some great story just like by what he's giving off, that uncomfortable, weird feeling that he's got, or something else.
The guy in the sweatpants cutoffs or whatever, with like his belly out, and you know, the wrong hat on.
And it could even be like a completely normal looking person that just has some kind of an uncomfortable thing about them, or just something that they're giving off that's like they're hiding something, or they're, you often see people who just have a naturally anguished expression.
Yeah.
You know, their brow is knitted, you know, like, what's that all? You know, it's like, it's, why would you grow up where that's like your resting face is to look like you're, you know, you're being terrified by like a giant spider in a cave or something.
And there you go. There's your comic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, was it always the intention to, was there ever an intention to do just, you know, straight art, or was it always to do comics?
Oh, well, I always wanted to do comics, but I didn't want to write my own comics when I started. The part I enjoy still is the drawing part. Like, that's, I always think of myself as a drawer. And I used to try to find people to write stories for me. And I'd, you know, like, you're a smart guy, write a comic story. And, it's really hard to do, for one thing. And I'd be like, nah, I don't want to draw that. I want to draw this thing I'm thinking. And then one day I realized, like, I got to write my own stories.
And you just had the, you know, you had the freedom of mind to let the characters sit sometimes. Like, they're, you know, and I think that's a crumb thing, too, where, you know, it doesn't have to be closure.
No.
Yeah.
No, there's to be like an emotional thing underlying everything that feels right. You know, it's probably like doing a comedy set. It has a certain flow to it. And you know, that's the ending, and doesn't have a narrative necessarily.
No, not narrative, but in comedy that, you know, generally the audience is expecting to be able to go like, it's done. That was the end.
Oh, I get that it was done.
There's a punchline there and it seems to have closure.
Is it done? Or did he have to go to the bathroom?
I try to explore that a little bit. Is it finished?
Thank you.
So you're a comedy fan?
Yeah. I didn't used to be. It's funny. I remember years ago, Bob Odenkirk and David Cross wrote to me. That's like, you know, 1993 or 4. And they were like, we're doing this show for HBO, you know, that's a comedy show.
Right.
Mr. Show. And I was like, I just pictured like two guys in suspenders in front of a brick wall. I just thought like, yeah, I don't want to. Comedy is horrible. I just thought of it as that world of comedy that existed in that world. And then, you know, and then when I finally saw the show, I was like, God damn it, why didn't I do that?
Oh, really? They wanted you to write?
Yeah, no, they wanted me to do the logo for the show and do like an animated thing.
Right, right.
And I liked that. They seemed cool guys on the phone, but I just had no faith in it, and I'd never seen any of that.
Oh, because
stuff.
your idea of what comedy was that just that, that tacky kind of like comedy, like evening at the Opera? Oh, really?
Like that kind, you know, sure. Just that world, you know?
Sure.
And I don't know, just felt old fashioned or something.
And you'd not kept up.
I had not kept up, you know, and I, you know, on TV still at that time, it was still the old world of comedy.
Sure.
Pretty much.
Sure.
And then I started meeting people like Dana Gould and Patton and all those
guys.
Yeah,
I think you might have invented those people.
I think I did.
I think that you're responsible for
Patton. I designed Patton. Yeah.
I think you did.
Yeah, in a laboratory.
No, no, I knew Patton when he was very young, you know, probably 22, 23.
Yeah.
And, you know, when he moved to San Francisco, I had just moved there as well. And he was definitely a full-on, you know, comic art, you know, morbid culture,
sure,
weirdo shit nerd.
Yeah, I know. First time I met him, he was fully formed, without a doubt.
Yeah. And but like, you know, I know you did did you do a record cover or a book cover for him or an illustration?
I did. He had a TV pilot and I did a thing for that.
Yeah, yeah. And, yeah. And you know, so how has comedy influenced your work? Stand up, per
well,
se?
You know, I was thinking how, I got really into the structure of a set, you know, uh-huh, of a comedy set,
sure,
and just how does that work? And, you know, I, like everybody else, I watched comedy and never thought about it once. Just thought, oh, the guy's telling a bunch of jokes. And then I started to get how it all goes together, how you set up the thing,
yeah,
how you have the pacing. And that, you know, even if I didn't find it funny at all, I got really impressed with comedians who could make that work over a full set,
mm-hmm,
and build up, always be funny,
the callback
and just the like saving your good joke for the right time.
Oh, right.
And just the whole flow of it,
right,
to me was a kind of a beautiful freeform narrative structure that we all kind of know, you know, we feel it, but
right,
we don't think about it.
It's storytelling, but with jokes,
right,
knowing where that comes, right. Was there a comic that you saw that the most with, or that you go to?
You know, one guy I think about all the time is Stephen Wright.
Just sure.
Because his humor seems like something you couldn't write. Like, it has to happen to you.
Right.
Like, and a lot of my writing is like that. Like, I can't just sit down and, like, what's going to happen? Like,
right,
it has to appear in
right,
my head and come to me. And I can just imagine him sort of being, you have to be receptive. And I'm sure he's very receptive to that.
Have to be receptive and have a pen.
And have a pen.
And some writing paper,
right,
of some
and
kind.
I'm sure he works very hard to hone those jokes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But nobody else could sit down and write a Stephen Wright
no,
set.
No. It's completely singular.
Singular.
What I noticed with, before we don't need to go book to book necessarily, but I was looking at Wilson before you came over. And like some of you guys do this. Like, I know that, you know, Crumb can, but he doesn't too much. But, like, Spiegelman certainly does that. There was almost sort of like a celebration of your ability to do several different comic styles.
Yeah. Yeah, I would like to not think I was just showing off. I mean,
No. But, I mean, I there was intent.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what happened was I had that book all written in little tiny, like, stick figure drawings.
Mm-hmm.
That character just popped into my life one day, and all of a sudden I couldn't stop writing.
Based on the feeling you had about a real person?
I was actually, my dad was dying in the hospital, much like Wilson's dad is in the book. And I went to sit with him, you know, this is the end.
Yeah.
And I thought, he's going to give me, like, this is, you know, where this very quiet, you know, self-involved man, not self-involved, self, you know, self-focused man. Is
right, because he's coming to the end.
He's coming to the end, and now he's going to offer me, like, the words, you know, the things he's never said to me, he's going to tell me. And as I was sitting there, I realized, like, that is so not going to happen. He's in his own thing. He wants nobody there. He just wants to, like, figure the shit out on his own. And so I was like, well, I don't want to, like, check my phone. It seems, like, disrespectful. So I got out my little sketch pad and I was like, I'm going to write a little comic and see if I can amuse myself.
While I'm sitting next to
my dying father, I was like, I'm going to do, you know, the yin and the yang. I'm going to do the opposite. And so I just made up this character, sort of a cranky version of myself, based on like my traveling that I'd done to get there. And then the like 3 days later, I had done hundreds of these. I mean, I just couldn't stop doing these little doodles.
Uh-huh.
And then I went home and I had been working on this big, ambitious graphic novel thing that I was doing. And I just immediately took that and threw it in the flat file and started working on Wilson and started drawing these. And I could, at first I was like, what style am I going to draw this in? Because some stories, some little pages were very serious, some were funny. And I started trying all these different styles. And then at a certain point, I was like, oh, I should just do it like this. Just each one has its own presence,
right,
and own style.
Yeah, yeah.
And that somehow worked.
Do you feel do you feel that because that happened when it happened, that, you know, emotionally, that you were able to process the grief?
I think it helped. You know, I look at that book and I have some kind of peace with my dad, you know, somehow through that book. You know,
was it a troubled relationship?
Not really, no. Yeah. But he was just very like non-demonstrative and you know, let me go on my own. You know, he's very much about like, you have your own life. I'm not going to intrude. But,
right,
you know, but you always want, you dream your whole life of that. Like, I want to tell you about the, you know, that we have a lot of money. You didn't know that.
Right, right. Surprise.
Yeah, surprise. Guess what? I've always been a billionaire.
Right. And I just got to make this life map to where the chest.
Yeah. Oh. Or just even like, I liked your comics, or so, you know, he's just like, he would never have said that.
Yeah,
so
he wouldn't have.
Never, no.
It's weird what you have to, you know, well, that's sort of that lesson you learn, that if you don't somehow put a reasonable, you know, self-parenting mode,
yes,
into your mind,
right,
you're fucked.
Yeah, you're fucked. Yeah.
Yeah, and usually you're fucked for a good long time before you realize that.
Right, right, right. So, you know, that book was largely about dealing with that, and then, you know, about the other struggles of, you know, becoming a parent. I was, you know, just had a kid right before he died, so.
Yeah. And you had a health scare yourself, right?
I did, yeah. I had a open heart surgery. It was fun.
I can't fucking.
Yeah.
What happened?
I had like a lifelong birth defect that, you know, it's like if it was on my ear or something, like, what the hell is that on your ear?
Yeah, right.
But it was like my heart had this huge heart valve that was like didn't connect. And so it was never quite working the whole time, well, my whole life. And at a certain, I was like 40, I don't know, 45, something like that. And all of a sudden I would be like walking up a hill in San Francisco and I was like, I got to sit down on the sidewalk. I'm tired. You know, and I just thought like, oh, that's what happens when you get to be 40.
40.
And yeah, everybody's like, nah, I don't think so. You know, the other people can walk up a hill, you know. And so I went to the doctor and he was like, oh my God, you know, this sounds like, it was like, you know, and I went to the cardiologist,
like,
you know,
flopping piece.
It was just a flopping, like, you know, walrus tusk or something. And they sent me to, you know, not emergency surgery, but pretty quick. And I had 8 hours of surgery.
Well, oh my God.
But the great thing about it, it's this, I got this old, like, war vet guy who went in and, like, you know, I can spare you the details of the chest, you know, they literally saw your breastplate open with a saw, like a power saw, open it up. And you're dead basically for 8 hours. I was out for 8 hours. You're on like a life machine that keeps your heart and lungs going.
They bypass your heart so they can work on it.
But your heart is stopped for 8 hours, you know. And so but basically the surgery is this beautiful origami kind of thing, like where they sew it and fold it into this thing where it's actually structurally stronger than it would be as a normal heart.
Uh-huh.
And so now, like, I go in the cardiologist, like, your heart is beautiful. It sounds like it's amazing, you know. So it's like better than it would have been if I just
anything.
So it's like, it's one of the rare, you know, huge life changing things that you come out and you're like, I feel great now, instead of like, I feel a little diminished from that.
Yeah.
You know?
And did that happen after your father died?
No, a little before, a couple of years before.
So you had to deal with that.
Yeah.
Like you had it, like I imagine when you going into open heart surgery, you're like,
done. I was totally checked out. Like, so now I do feel like I know what it's like to die a little bit. You know, I was really like, I was like said goodbye. I had all my affairs in order, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And your wife just was sort of like, what did you?
She was shocked, in deep shock.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And every once in a while, she thinks, she goes, oh, my God, that happened. You
right.
know,
like, well, it's weird, just, right?
Yeah.
You put it in a different part of your brain when that's a PTSD yeah. in itself.
Totally, totally.
And you came out of it? And, yeah. And when you woke up, was it like, you
know? Oh, it was so weird to wait. Just like, ugh, you know, I, yeah. she said I woke up and, like, lurched like a zombie. Like, I leapt up and, like, you know, reached out. Like, I was trying to escape.
Did you find that you were... Like, I notice when I see public personalities who go through open heart surgery that, did you find yourself more vulnerable or more sensitive or more, like, the idea that you literally, you know, your heart was way open?
No, I felt tougher in a way. I felt like,
oh, really?
Anything, you know, people be, oh, I got stabbed or something. It's like, yeah, big deal. I took yeah. a cannonball to the chest, basically.
You and know, was there a threat of you dying or needing, you know, like, I mean, when you were going in,
oh,
were they
in,
like...
in the surgery, I think it was, he was quite horrified at how bad it was. You know, I think it was, like, I really got the greatest guy in the world who did it in the way he did it. Because otherwise they can give you, like, a replacement valve that you have to get switched out every 10 years.
Yeah.
Or, you know, that would have been a nightmare.
Oh, my God. That's, well, good. Congratulations.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
But it didn't like I don't see any surgery in your comics. Is there any surgery?
No, I haven't really done. It's more sublimated of just like, you know, crazed violence that happens out of the blue. You know, after that happened, I would have these dreams where just horrible, you know, people were eating me alive, and so, you know, just horrible nightmares
really?
Came out of that. Yeah, so I've really repressed it because you know, you're just completely out for the whole thing. Like, I didn't feel any pain the whole time.
And it was, but then when you woke up, I imagine looking at the scar that
runs. It was intense. Yeah.
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 So let's talk a little bit about a ghost world, because that, you know, that was sort of something that really hadn't happened, where, you know, a comic like that becomes a film that becomes very popular and it won awards,
yeah.
right? Did you get an Oscar?
Who we
got
didn't an Oscar? Win an Oscar, but we got nominated.
Yeah.
A Beautiful Mind beat us out.
But Ghost World was, how did you feel about, cause like I had I remember having an attachment to the comic and that, you know, if you're a person that can read graphic novels, like
right.
that, yeah, I think some people just don't have it, like to sort it's, of like put the picture and the text together
oh, yeah.
you know, subconsciously,
yeah.
that it works and a world is created, that, you know, you have a relationship with that, I imagine,
right.
certainly as the artist, but even as a guy who read it, like, you know, I was always sort of like, how are you going to create that space?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Zweigoff did a pretty good job with that. That, you know, that you had these, again, like we talked about before, that your characters are carrying the, you know, the burden of history in a way.
Yeah. Right.
That, you know, how do you make them live in that sparse environment? How did you feel he did with that?
I was around for the whole thing.
You yeah.
know, I wrote the screenplay with him and,
uh-huh.
And he was real nice to just sort of let me, he was like, he sort of admitted, like, I don't really like get these girls as well as you do. And so he would let me make all the calls for, you know, like what they're wearing and like what their rooms look like and all that stuff. So I felt, you know, I felt like I was a big part of it. I felt like, you know, he made a really good film. You know, it's really hard to make a film out of another work. You know,
yeah.
it's not easy at all. And I felt like he brought some energy and life to it that if we had just transcribed the comic, it just wouldn't have been there.
Was because he did the Crumb documentary, was that part of your appeal to him and him to you in a way?
It was, you know, I met him after the Crumb documentary. I had known of him for years because Crumb always draws pictures of him and they
yeah.
were in a band together and all that. And, you know, I met him and I just felt like, okay, he's somebody I could totally understand their sense of humor. I know where he's coming from. You know, he's like you know, from the Midwest and, you know, we just have this similar,
right.
You know, he's probably 15 years older than me.
Yeah.
But he was sort of the older brother that I didn't quite have around,
right, right.
you know, and,
yeah.
and
the so one that wasn't terrifying.
Yeah. Or, yeah. Or just
chaotic.
Who was around, you know, like I don't know. He felt like somebody I could totally get along with. And I thought, if I'm going to ever make a movie, it's not going to be anybody who I get along with better than this guy.
Right.
So,
and you did too.
Yeah, we did too.
Art School Confidential.
Yeah.
What I learned in watching those movies was that it's very hard to get the specific depth of characters that are created in a graphic novel
yeah.
from actors. That
it's very different.
It's yeah, because there's a they're in some ways they're more human in the graphic novel.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I'm doing comics, it's to me that's the ultimate sort of one-to-one communication. Like I'm drawing it myself; nobody's touching it.
Yeah,
it's just me. You're reading it. You're not. Nobody's over your shoulder going, "Look at this panel." You know, you're. It's a complete one-to-one communication.
Right.
And if you're watching a movie, it's, you know, 700 people making it for an audience of 400 or, you know, five on your couch or whatever. It's,
right.
It's a very different thing.
And you're conscious of that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, usually the best movies are made out of a short story.
Where right, just, right,
you
right.
Have, you have like a...
You can fill in the gaps.
I think it's great when you start with a character and you have a kind of a simple through line.
Right.
And you have that. And you so, you know, like, okay, I know this character and then you bring it to life.
Right.
Well, but when you have to start cutting out, you know, like we had to cut out 15 years of this plot because it's just, you know, it's a 900-page book.
And add a guy.
To
accommodate the cut of the 900 pages.
Right.
We just added a guy.
Right. We just had a guy. You know, he explains it all.
Yeah, that's the problem. But this one, Patience, the new book, which I enjoyed a lot, and it's fresh in my mind. It's weird when I start looking at all the stuff of yours that I read over my life.
Sure.
That, like, I'm like, oh, my God, I read all this stuff. But it sits in a place. You know, you right. occupy a place in my mind that is a style and a form and characters, and it defines certain things about the way I think and about how I see things. In the new book, like, it looks like you, but it feels like, were you a little looser with the drawing?
I was, you know, that's the longest book I've ever done by many pages. And so I was trying to keep it where it looked somewhat uniform in the style, but that to me, every page has a different kind of presence to it. You know, there's a lot of different things going on.
Right.
Visually that
right.
I didn't necessarily want to telegraph for the audience, make it really apparent. But for me, you know, it's just a different flow throughout the whole thing.
And also, like, you know, from the very beginning, there's an inkling, like, you know, once you see what the story is.
Right.
You know, there's a couple ways that can go just by, and I'm not a huge, you know, science fiction.
Nor am I.
Guy,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But you do start to sort of like, is he going to erase himself?
Right.
You know, like, you know, is he going to solve the crime?
Right.
Isn't he just by virtue of going back in time, even if he does anything, doesn't that fuck everything up?
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. No, I had to believe me. That was not stuff I loved having to worry about, but I got into it, you know?
Yeah.
And it actually, this, as much as this is a narrative that's maybe the most, you know, easily understood narrative I've done, or, you know, the most sort of mainstreamish narrative I've done. It was almost an experimental book for me. I was trying to do something that I had to really occupy myself with, like the flow of the story and the narrative. And I was hoping that would free up my mind in other ways, which it did. You know, it made me able to do those crazy images, and it all came out of that. And
right. So you had to sort of, for the first time, like, really lay down the story first?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of those great things where you have, like, in comedy, if you know, you set something up at the beginning and then there's a callback later and people think you're a genius.
Right.
You know, like, oh, that's from the
joke
before.
How did he do that?
You
yeah.
Well, there is that element where you set up this stage of characters, but the narrative is displaced by the time travel thing, so you don't really know the significance of any event.
Right.
You know, other than, you know,
right.
she's murdered, and
right.
I don't think I'm spoiling anything.
No.
But you did see recurring characters going, oh, how's this all going to play out? But the
right.
one that ultimately ends up playing out, I didn't see it coming.
Good. Okay, good. I worked hard.
That worked.
Yeah. I mean, my hope, and of course, this is impossible in this world, was that people would read the book having no idea what it was. You know, they're just, oh.
I didn't.
Good. Oh, good.
And I was sort of expecting, like, you know, like, I looked at the cover, I'm like, well, here we go into some borderline sad lives.
Right.
And
that's how it begins. You know, the first 10 pages, they're worrying about their money troubles. And I really wanted
classic
people.
Classic you.
I wanted people to, okay, I get it. You know, this is good. And then turn the page, like, what the, you know.
Man,
and then 20 pages later, like, wait a minute. How did we get in the future, you know?
Yeah.
But now, you
definitely
know.
Definitely did work
now
like
every
that.
Review that comes out, it tells like 90% of the story. It's so, you know, it's like, well, you know, Norman Bates kills Janet Leigh in the shower and then great things happen, you know. Then it's,
that's
watch it
well,
play
that,
out.
That
then
fucking
his mother,
sucks.
You know, yeah, it's just, yeah.
You know, and I'd forgotten that. I'd gotten so busy that, you know, I don't make the time to read graphic novels, because I fucking eat them up. They're sure. actually something I can do, you know, I can't, it's hard for me to get through a whole book.
Sure.
But like, if I sit down with the graphic novel, and like yeah. I did, it was just the other night, I'm like, I didn't stop. I went
yeah,
all
yeah,
the way.
Great. Yeah. It's and then like an hour, it's an hour and 10 minutes or something, you know, it's like
a short,
short
movie.
Movie. Yeah. It's what we all want. We wish movies were like that.
But also like, it's just interesting when, who is the audience for it now? You know,
well, yeah.
Because I know your stuff.
Right.
And you know, and it's like, I've had this conversation about stand-ups too. You have this
sure.
window
right.
where you're culturally relevant.
Right.
And then you're still doing what you do and you're, right. you're growing in it and you're
sure.
evolving. But your audience is sort of like, I got kids. I got, you
know, well, yeah. Well, it's probably easier just to buy a graphic novel than to go out to the comedy club. So it's, you know,
you're benefiting there.
True. Yeah. You know, and I really have a lot of, there's like really young, you know, people like late high school.
Sure, they're
like,
yeah.
read.
Well, they're like you and I were with Crumb. Like
right.
there's always the great thing about what you do is that it's all there to be discovered.
Right.
And you can discover it for the first time. Like,
right.
you know,
right.
you're not bringing any baggage. You don't have to go to
no.
YouTube. It's like, look, this is a book that I found and
right.
you're showing it to a kid who's going like, what is that?
Yeah.
And it's all
yeah.
new.
There was a girl last night who told me she grew up in some like tea party town in some crappy,
yeah.
you know, Central Valley town and just was so alienated, just felt like, you know, she's like real oppressive Christian family and stuff. And she said she was in a used bookstore and found a beat up copy of Ghost World and it like changed her life. And that
oh.
to me was just like, that's worth everything.
Oh, that's the best.
It was the best thing, you know?
Yeah. It was like, you know, like there's that moment that some people who live in pain have where, you know, because you're so caught up in these patterns that, you know, insulate you from allowing the external to destroy you, that, you know, that becomes your life. And then all of a sudden you're given the gift of this thing that makes you go like, oh, there's another world out there.
Yeah.
You know,
and that it wasn't just like on Instagram or, you know,
right,
it's like in a
right.
used bookstore.
Right,
that to me was like, oh, you know, that's what I dreamed of.
That moment where somebody, you know, feels, you know, not alone and validated
yeah.
and not like a freak.
Right.
And they're like,
right.
I'm going where the freaks
right.
are.
Yeah. And now she's living in LA.
Yeah.
You know, so I was like, all right, you made
saved
it.
Her.
You made it.
So like, I know there's a struggle, you know, certainly with comedy but is your mom still around?
Yeah.
That, you know, when you know, you feel finally like you're validated to them. You
yeah.
know, where they don't just sort of like, well, you know, when you're done with this.
Right, when you go become a dentist.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, my mom, the auto mechanic, couldn't pull that on me too well, you know, because she
yeah.
had really followed her own crazy
right,
path.
Right, right. So she's always been on board and.
Yeah, you know, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
She's certainly never voiced any complaints.
But do you, but having done some work for the New Yorker, not that she sounds like necessarily
New
Yorker.
She is a New Yorker person, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So was that a big deal?
That's the biggest deal. I mean, that was the tragedy of my life when my dad was in that hospital.
Yeah.
My first New Yorker cover was coming out. And
yeah.
he died 2 days before it hit the stands. And that was like all my life. You got to do a New Yorker cover. That would be the best. You know, do a New Yorker.
He said that?
That was his thing for his whole, and he was fan for every minute of my life.
Yeah.
And the fact that, and he was telling the nurses in the hospital, he's doing a New Yorker cover.
Oh,
and they were
really?
Like, what? I don't know what that is.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that was just the ultimate, like, fuck you from God that he didn't get to see that. Yeah. That was literally, that's when you know there is a God and he's a malevolent creature.
Oh, is there? Oh, my. I hope
it's
not.
It's bad. We're in bad shape.
I've dismissed the possibility.
Yeah.
Do you struggle with that or no?
No. No, my family couldn't have been more atheistic.
It's a relief, isn't it? Somewhat.
It is.
It's because, like, you think that if you had the ability to suspend your disbelief or were brought up with that you wouldn't seek all these different outlets to express your own struggle with the seven deadly sins. I mean,
right.
you know, that's the beautiful thing about the seven deadly sins is that they're built in, man.
Right.
So, nobody's going to kick them.
Right.
But, you know, if all you do is, you know, beg for forgiveness for indulging them, then you don't get to sort of celebrate the struggle.
Right. I mean, on the flip side, I really had to like devise my own morality in a way, you know, because you're not given that as a young kid. These are like the moral principles that you guide your life by. You know, it was just all, I had to sort of observe the way the world works and kind of figure out, like, what do I really believe, you know, in a moral sense? You
What are they? Like, in a general way.
Oh, and
that people are, you know, are generally, craven and troubled and uncomfortable, and they're going to do a lot of things to relieve themselves. And
I think there's some, you know, screenwriting principle where it's, you know, I'm not that I don't necessarily believe in, but it's something like, you know, all your characters are trying to work towards a place of comfort. You know, they're trying to make themselves more like comfortable, relaxed, happy, you know, and all that. And,
right.
and they're going through all these obstacles. And it's, you know, I sort of think of every person is looking for that, you know,
yeah.
they're looking for a certain, everybody wants respect and they want that, you know, that kind of, you know, mental satisfaction, you know, that kind of feeling of like everything's okay. Whenever I think about the human race, I'm impressed that we've got things pretty well together compared to how it really could
right.
be so horrifically chaotic, and it's kind of a miraculous.
Yeah, and it's not because of law necessarily.
No,
that's what always sort of fascinates me, because I remember years ago, you know, that, you know, there's no reason it shouldn't just be a chaotic clusterfuck out there every day.
It really should just be
just crazy,
just horrific post-apocalyptic world.
Yeah.
You know, if, you know, sort of half the people in the world had their way, it would be like that. And there's the other half that somehow
right.
compensate for that, you know.
Right. Well, that's why, you know, it, at least when you see somebody like Trump become a reality,
right.
you're like, oh, there they are.
They're
the ones that
right.
might make it difficult
and
for everybody.
And it's so easy to feel like, you know, he's just going to take over and become the dictator, and then we're in Nazi Germany, and then we're,
The one good thing about a democracy, even a failing one, is it's a little tricky to pull that off.
Yeah, yeah.
You'd have to get a lot of states on your side. You'd have to, you know, get a lot of, local police on your
right.
side. The military has to turn on its own people. A lot of things, obviously, it's happened in history,
right.
and you don't want to be that guy that says, could never happen here, and
could
then all
never
of a
happen again, but
be, you know, doodling on, you know, a piece of shoe leather in a camp somewhere.
I've always been really fascinated with conspiracy theories, but they never make sense, because you just, how many people do you know who can coordinate anything?
Well, that's exactly
right.
Like
a phone call, you know.
My observation about conspiracy theories is they serve the same purpose as religious dogma.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, to make sense and have a feeling of control over something that is, makes no sense and
right.
can be read many ways.
Right.
It just becomes this unprovable set of dogmatic things
right.
that people commit to.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the fucked up thing about religion and those kind of things in general, is that, you know, the truth is not relevant.
Right. Right. No. And they state that, you know,
yeah,
it's about faith.
Right, yeah.
And that's what, but I love the brain power that goes into a conspiracy theory, and just that kind of Byzantine, you know, building of world. It's like writing a comic very much.
Right. And it's all about what you were saying before, is it's human beings, you know, trying, it's another manifestation of human beings trying to feel safe and comfortable in a way.
Right. I mean, certainly through writing characters and a lot of unpleasant characters, you know, I often start with a character like Wilson, who's sort of an off-putting guy, and my goal is to find a way to love that guy by the end of the book. And that's, you know, certainly that I can do that with, you know, maybe not with Ted Cruz, but with
people.
Some poor schmuck at the Trump rally.
Sure,
you know, it's easy to think, like, who is this guy? How did he get like that?
Well, some of your characters would definitely be there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. All right. Well, that's great, man. It was great talking to you.
You too.
Are you doing anything else down here? You just doing book stuff? You got any TV projects or movie projects happening?
There is a Wilson movie coming out.
Really?
In the fall, yeah.
Who's playing Wilson?
Woody Harrelson is Wilson.
Wow.
Yeah.
He's very good.
Yeah.
He can do anything.
I saw him, you know, do 2 days of shooting, and it was hilarious.
It's already shooting? Who's directing it?
It's this guy, Craig Johnson, who's made a film called The Skeleton Twins with Kristen Wiig and Bill Hader.
Oh, right. People like that movie.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
And Laura Dern plays Wilson's wife.
Oh, that's great.
It's good, yeah.
And you wrote the script?
I wrote the script.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah,
and
I'm excited.
The, what's the release date on that?
It's fall. We don't know the official date yet.
And the new book, Patience, is great. And it was an honor talking to you, man.
Oh, you too, man. This was really fun.
He was amazing, right? Some of that interview is going to stay with me, just the way he sees things. It's weird, the ones that stick, but that one's going to stick. I hope you enjoyed that. Thanks again to Starry Station for sponsoring today's show. Say goodbye to your Wi-Fi problems and those confusing blinking lights. Starry Station was designed to give you better internet throughout your home. You can see your entire network at a glance, get suggestions on how to fix problems, and finally know if you're getting the internet speed you paid for. If you ever need help, you can request a support call from the touchscreen, and a Starry expert will call you in minutes. Learn more about Starry Station at starry.com/Marin. Also, don't forget, we're matching all donations that our listeners give to the Electronic Frontier Foundation as they fight off the podcast patent troll. Go to eff.org/WTF, and whatever you can contribute will match all contributions until they hit $5,000. This is an ongoing battle, people, and it's a battle for a lot of small businesses, a lot of tech companies, and now it's hit home and landed right here in the garage and the homes and basements and closets and studios of all podcasters. So think about that, and please try to help out. Support the cause. Also, go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. My show, Marin, is on Wednesdays at 9 p.m. There's a few more left, I think five, six maybe. My tour dates for Rochester, Spokane, Salt Lake City, Bloomington, Albuquerque. They're all up at WTFpod.com/tour. So, good. I got a new paddle, a new box, a new toy. Not even a paid promotion, but Earthquaker sends me shit, and sometimes I'll plug it in, and it's like, ooh, what is that? This Earthquaker spatial delivery thing. I don't know what you're... What is that? Boomer lives!